Okay, so let's start with the virtual machines lecture of today. Last time we have made our first steps into the world of translating functional language. So far we have had an introduction into the basic machine facilities. There were lots of similarities to what the CIMA had before, so we could be quite quick about that. We've dealt with our usual expressions. We have had a rough idea of how to handle variables when we encounter them in our expressions. And also we have talked about, or finished last time, I think, with the idea of how to bind expressions to names with let expressions. So I think we can now safely continue with functions, function definitions, function calls, and function body execution. So let's have a look how this works. So for the function definitions, we have seen that there, or we have indicated that there is already some support via a heap item that we have tagged to be a function. So this is considered to be a functional value that we can pass around and we can somehow create and use. So this is the general concept. You've also already indicated that functional value by itself is consisting of several components, such as some reference to code to be executed whenever the function is applied to some parameters. There's the concept of the global pointer that is usually active during the definition of a function, which has to be packed into the functional value when the function is created, such that at the use of the function, the references to global variables inside a function body can still be resolved to the same thing as originally planned. And then finally there is the field in the functional value that is there for parameters that have been already bound to some value. This is something that we didn't have so far in the CIMA. Remember, we've talked about or at least hinted that there is a concept of under supplying a function. This means that there you have an application of a functional value on a few parameters, but not enough to really bind all of the parameters that are there. And in those cases, the semantics would be that the outcome of such an application is not the actual execution of the function, but again, you get a function as a return value, functional value in that case, but you would have a function which is already partially or has already partially bound its parameters to those that have been found at the application spot. So with that, you usually, or you have at least the potential for a functional value to carry a few already bound parameters with it. And this is why there is this third field in the functional value for the so far bound parameters. So in order to allocate such a functional value in the stack, we need to talk about the semantics of the function definition. And at the point where we create such a thing, there is a few steps to go. So first of all, we said that there is this environment of global variables for which we need to produce a global vector to store in the functional value in order to access them later on. So this would be kind of the first step. Then there is the need for the argument vector to be filled with these partially bound parameters at the creation time of the functional value. This is usually not bound at all, since it has not been applied yet, but we need to still prepare the initial data structure to be used later on whenever there is a application of the functional object. And last but not least, we need to create the actual functional value for the thing in terms of an F object on the heap that contains the references to those vectors. So these are the parts that we need to make sure that that are there. So that's what we are seeing here on the this slide, where the code generation scheme for the function declaration is. So there's several parts. There's a part that is responsible for the creation of this global vector to be used within the function at runtime. So you could assume this part of the code generation scheme to be responsible for that. Why is that? Well, there is the concept of global variables that can be found within the expression that the function maps to, and you can just scan that for every occurrence of a variable that is not defined locally in either the expression itself via some let binding or in the parameters list. So if you find any variable that is not introduced directly in this function definitions, you assume them to be free, you can come up with an algorithm that does that, that is running kind of on the structure of the expression, and it gives you all the free variables or unbound variables of this declaration, and these are the ones that need to be bound via the definitions that surround them, and or the bindings that surround this thing. And in order to conserve that, because later on we might lose these references, or well, overshadow them, or somehow change what they evaluate to, so we need to conserve them for later use. And that is a thing that we can do by step by step. Applying this getVar macro in order to get references to those variables right now and put references to those things on the push down step by step, and then pack them together with this make vector instruction that we're going to look at a little bit later on. And this thing can be parameterized with how many components the newly generated globals vector should have. So this is the part for the global pointer saving. Then there's the second thing that we see here, which is new, which is this make funval A. This is the, well, kind of a combined instruction that is there for the rest of the open things. So there's the list of already bound parameters. You remember that? This is for in the case where we declare this function, or define this function, is still empty. So this is a thing that is shared among all these declarations, so we don't need a separate thing, but we can pack it into the process where we create the actual functional value anyway. And this is done in this make funval A. This A is a parameter that is used that serves as a reference to the entry point into the actual code to be executed for that function. So this you will find again over here as the jump target to be used for executing the actual function's code. And at the point of defining this function, you don't want to immediately execute the thing. So this is why there is this jump B that finally jumps over the actual code that is produced for executing the function body. So, well, we can continue with whatever comes after the definition and only execute the code at A whenever there is an actual apply of the function. So this is kind of the management stuff around the definition of the thing. Now, for the code of the actual expression that is used or is mapped to by this function definition, this is what we find here. So there's a prologue and an epilogue of the function body, which is this trk and return k, with k being the number of parameters that are used. And well, we will look at that a little bit more closely later on. So far, I don't want to lose too much words on that. Just keep in mind that there's a few corner cases with this under and over supply of arguments, and these trg and return instructions are there to actually catch these corner cases. Apart from that, that's just the code generation for the expression E remaining. So this is that part, and since the whole function is supposed to return some value, this is the code V version of the whole thing. So code V of E is used in here with the address environment that is given by, well, the where is it? Yeah, so it has the globals that are mapped to by this ZI that you got via the free function. So these are all the things that are not locally bound. And then there is the bindings for the parameters, for which you introduce these local values. And that is already all that you need for the variables that are inside, except for some local let bindings or other internal things, but they usually keep their naming schemes by themselves, so you don't have to care about that.
So these globals always need to be a bound inspector for any call or any setup of this function?
Yeah, you wanted to know whether all of the globals need to be in.
Yeah, we always have this get market for a get market, right?
Yeah.
For the globals.
Yeah, so.
Just for one function object.
Yeah, but only for the globals that we actually, or well, the ones that are really used in that sense. So.
Okay, so this is already like.
Yeah, it just boils down to what you really make use of within the thing. It's not path sensitive, so you can't really come up with a solution where you just put those globals that will, of course, be like that, but everything that's potentially referred to should be found in there and will be given to the whole thing via the free function. You have to design your free function like that, of course, but. So you only generate those that you really need. Good. So then let's continue with the actual semantics of the newly introduced things. So first thing would be this make vec g. Where was it used? This was the instruction that we used after we have gotten all the bindings of the local variables. And, well, in that situation, we have created a lot of content on the stack. Each of those cells referring to a value object for some global variable or free variable within the function. And this make vector thing would transfer that into a list that can be used in the context of a function object or functional value, and this is what you see here. So the values still remain here in memory, they just are transferred from over here into the list of global variables. They are consumed from the stack and replaced with a reference to the actual vector. And yeah, that is the virtual machine semantics for that. There's another call to the new operator. This time we're creating a vector of size n, and that's that. And then you run through the generated bindings for your global variables and just store them in there. And you might ask, what is the, how is it indexed? And well, the first cell here points to this thing, which is also referred to from the first cell of the vector. So it's the, if you run your index in this direction, you would run it in this to come up with the same elements again. Okay, so the next thing that we wanted to do was to finalize the data structure for the function, emanating from the result that we've seen on the slide before, particularly the the reference to the vector of globals that lies on top of the stack, and out of that we now construct a new functional value object, this one over here, that has the tag f, of course, at the beginning. Then we said it would have reference to code in the code memory, code part of our memory that goes here. And then, of course, there's the original globals in the vector that are still there, but now are referenced from this third field. And, well, what is remaining is this preparation for undersupplying a function, partially binding parameters, which would at the beginning consist of a vector of size 0, depending on the flow that this functional value takes within our program. This will be added to at some point, or might just play no role when we supply the correct amount of parameters, and well, we'll see how that turns out to be. But in general, this is the semantics that we need for this instruction. So it's a new vector, this time with no content, and a new functional object that the top of the stack points to. And that's that. So far, so easy. So with that, we have done the make vector and the make functional value. Jump and return, jump is kind of standard. The only thing is now target and return. But before we go into that, let's have a look at how that works out with an example. So our example is the definition here for F, which is this fun B maps to A plus B, with the environment A maps to locally 1, and the initial stack distance is 1, so that goes directly here. So to produce the code for that, what do we have to do first? We should maybe take care of the of the names that occur in the expression part over here, that whether we can resolve these names locally, or whether we have to refer to some global binding for these things. And, well, what would you say? Well, it's already kind of given on the slides. This A thing is a global variable, and that's also why it is in the initial address environment. And the B thing is a local name that occurs in the parameters of the thing. So for the three variables, we have one, which is the A, and bound one, which is B, which is a parameter. So if you think back to the code generation scheme, we first of all had to make sure that the free variables are somehow conserved and accessible later on. So we need to provide some code to save the bindings of that for the global vector that we want to feed into our functional object. So that's probably what we do. So for the A is the only one, so we will create code for that, and this is obtained by a get var of A, and get var for a local is usually computed as a push lock, of course. Push lock always uses parameter stack distance minus one. Stack distance is one at the beginning, so this is push lock of zero. And with that we get the reference to whatever A is bound to on the top of the stack. And with that we're already done with the globals, the free variables of the function, and we turn those things now into a global vector via make vector of size one, because it's just one global, and this moves the reference to A into this list thingy, and refers to this list from the top of the stack, which is then used in the next step in order to create the function value object, make funval, and for that we're going to use a reference to A, where we store the actual code of that thing. And we said that directly after creating the functional object, we usually want to jump to some place behind the actual function code, because not to be executed now, but later on. So what remains now is to take care of that the expression belonging to the function is translated correctly. So at the label A, where the function starts, we just in a very dumb manner surround everything with TRG1 and return1. We don't know what that does yet, but this is our prologue and epilogue. So in the function itself, what needs to be done is we need to translate the trigger the value code generation of whatever expression we find here, and that is the the value object code generation. Sorry, value object code generation for an arithmetic binary operator works like that: you perform the make basic thing at the end, and then refer to the basic value code generation scheme, which consists of add and basic code generation for the operands, which are for our purposes this and this thing. And for these operands, we need the basic values. So, for A and B are variables. Those are usually value objects. So we put a get basic behind each of them. apart from that, it depends on how they are declared, whether these are locals or globals. For our purposes, the A is a global thing, so there's a push global zero and an eval in the generation scheme. And for the B, being a local variable, there's a push log and an eval. And yeah, that is that. Okay. So, let's move on to the actual point in the code where we make use of whatever we have defined so far. So, function application it is. Function application is usually the thing that we do whenever we encounter the code pattern like this. So there is just a sequence of expressions. In those, we usually interpret the first one as some thing that delivers a functional value, and the others we don't really care about. We just bind to parameters as much as we have, and trigger the application of the first functional value to everything behind. So in terms of what that means for the virtual machine and the semantics of this expression would be, well, we first of all need to somehow allocate the stack frame containing, of course, continuation data of what to do after the application has been done. We need to bind the actual values of the parameters. Now, with values that are determined at the application point in the code, and evaluate, of course, the expression object itself, and apply everything to each other. For the actual parameters, there is the again two variants depending on CBV or CBN. Either evaluating the actual parameters right now, or just leave them as their as a references to give them inside of the function and evaluate them when they're actually really needed. So let's have a look at the code generation for this closure-based variant, the one from CBN. So there's the application of E prime to some E0 to EM minus 1, which works like, well, first of all, there is an allocation of the frame, which works kind of similar to what we have seen on the CIMA, which prepares a few management cells on the stack as first parts of the frame. Then we complete the frame by pushing the actual parameters on there. So this is done here with the code C schemes of the parameters EM minus 1 to E0. And in the same manner as we have seen that from CIMA, we evaluate from right to left. And then finally, we come up with the actual functional value of E prime. And this one we have to immediately evaluate contrary to the parameters, because we really need to know what is in there. So that's why we have this code V in there. And then we perform the actual application, which is, well, somewhat similar to what call does. In detail, it might deviate a little bit. And what might also be a little bit different to before is that the continuation address is already taken as a parameter to the mark. And I think we have done that differently for this call thing. Okay. if you want to have the call by value semantics, of course, we have to switch around a little bit in the code generation schemes and using value object code generation instead of closure code generation for the arguments, but I think that's pretty straightforward. So, looking at an example, applying F to 42 with the address environment F mapping to local of 2 and stack distance 2, what we will get is, well, just applying the code generation scheme from before. This is a mark A on level of 2, and it turns out that mark will create a few cells on the stack itself, particularly 3, so that's why the stack distance is growing that much. Then we have to make sure to produce the code C for the first parameter. Oh no, well, code C not, we say it's call by value, so we will use code V, which will translate into, well, 42 is an actual value. We need to pack that in order to come up with a value object. So first of all, we start with loading C and then creating the packed version via make basic, which will transfer that on the heap and just store a reference on top of the stack, increasing the stack distance again. So, yeah. Then with that, we are done with the parameter. Now we have to take care of the actual function value expression, and that is a thing that is just a name that we need to generate code for. This is considered to be a local with index 2. Locals are push lock with parameter always stack distance minus 2. Stack distance is 6. So subtracting 2 from that is a push local of 4. So that's why this goes here, and then we apply like the scheme says. And with that, we can continue after A when the application has been dealt with. A little bit of a larger example. Examples over examples. So there's CBB again, so direct code instead of call by name, stack distance 0 for start, and the a little bit larger example from here, where we what is different to before? Well, now we have a let binding here. And if you start already with a let binding, we can. This is already a hint that there is kind of probably a global variable used later on in the function. And actually, there it is. This appears again here. Then there's the let binding of f to the function value right here, where there's a local variable that is used within the body of the function. And finally, we apply the function to some value. And this f applied to 42 is a thing that we have already seen on the slide before, I guess. Yeah, this was this one. So this has a pretty similar code sequence. So this is a again, the stack distance by some magical way was already 2, which is what we started from right here, so we can kind of literally copy what we have found there, just with a little bit of different labels here. So this is marking the continuation point of the whole thing, then the load of the constant together with a make basic to pack it into a heap value, pushing the local 4 for the F. And, well, we can't see right now here that this is going to be a 4 that strongly depends on what we have in our address environment, and well, this will be probably the A binding at index 1, and F will be bound as the second component of the globals around here. So this will be mapping to 2, 6 minus 4, minus 2 is 4, so that's why this is push log 4. And then we do an application and then end the whole thing. So this is the expression that you have seen on the slide before. Then there is the declaration of this little fellow over here, and I think we also remember this one from a little bit earlier. Yeah, that was this one. Coincidentally, also the address environment will somehow correspond to what we meet in our example. So that's how it has been engineered. So the code from, where was it? From here, from the function, will in that sense be found again later on in our larger example. So this is plugged into here. And well, what can we find for that? Well, there is the starts, I think, over here and ends with the return, I think. Yeah, that's it. So this is the part that corresponds to this one. And finally, there is the first part of the let binding with let A 17, which is for our purposes just these two instructions. So this is a, oh dear, this is a just a 17 and packed into a heap item with a make basic, and just remains on the stack for later reference, and the address environment will map to this index for the A as a global variable. So the function definition that follows will then push the well, as a, will act as a local variable the in order to use it inside the function. In the prologue of this function definition, we have to refer to that. So this push local, put in, push local 0, which will take the reference to this thing onto the push down again. We will then pack it into a global vector, add it to a functional value, and then continue jumping to B, where we then jump right into the function application. And the other thing is just the code generation for this A plus B, mainly this add thing and the two operands, and then a packing instruction to put the whole thing on the heap, surrounded with targ and return in order to deal with corner cases that we haven't uncovered yet. So this is the example made a little bit larger and put together whatever we have seen before, ending with this thing. Okay, so let's have a look at what we have actually done so far. So in terms of view of layout of what we want to achieve on the stack is there's this management part of the stack that I have not shed too much light on so far, but these are three cells on the in the frame that contain the continuation of the program after the function has been executed with a PC old. together with the old frame pointer and the old global pointer. So they need to be saved. So that's why there's three organizational cells pointed to directly by the frame pointer. And apart from that, all that needs to be given to the function is its arguments, and they come right above that. And everything following there is for local use of the function body itself. So this is how stack frame for the MAML should look like. So let's have a look at what those instructions should actually really do. So there's a mark A. What was mark A? Mark A was something that we found at this, the start of a function application, allocating the frame, it says in the comment. So this is this also gets the continuation address. So this is responsible for creating that part of the frame of a function. So let's have a look at what it does from a semantic point of view. So mark A it is. It's emanating from an already working function. So there's a frame pointer going somewhere already. There's a global pointer that points to some list of globals for the current application of our current function. And with mark A, we prepare the stack with organizational cells for a new function call. So what we need to do is add cells on top of that, and that's what we're going to do here. We will fill them with a PCOld, FPOld, and GPOld. From the point of view of here, the old things are just our current data structures. So we fill in the current references from the current pointers. So the old frame pointer is kind of where our frame pointer has pointed before. So this is this thing. This should thus point to there, and this translates to, in that view, to this thing here. The other thing that needs to be saved is the current GP value, and this is pointing here. Thus, we create this link over here. The only thing is, what is the old the PC old in that sense? Well, this is not directly a copy of what the program counter is right now, because that would point into the that would point directly into the generation of all the parameters. And this is clearly not where we would like to end up. Instead, we would like to end up here after we have applied the function to continue where this label is. And that's why this goes as a parameter here to be used as content for this, well, what we have marked as PCO, but semantically be the continuation address after the application of the newly constructed function. So we fill in A and the top of the stack. So much for mark. What is the other thing that we need to look at? Then there's the apply. So apply now, what does that do? The apply now finds a situation where there is already the stack frame prepared. The frame pointer is already pointing to the correct place, like this. And the what else is there? Yeah, the local variables are already, and the local, well, the parameters already prepared on the stack. So, and the final part that there was the evaluation of the function value object that is supposed to be on top of the stack. So this is what you see here. Top of the stack points to a function object. The function object is already filled with some things. So what is the apply gonna do? well, the apply will then have the start address for the actual code for the function carrying with it. So this needs to go into the PC, and that's what you see over here. What else is there? Well, for the execution of this function object, we got the its global environment in a global vector given to us in the structure. So what we need to do is we need to make sure that the GP is pointing to that. So this thing goes right in there, like this. So now the GP really points to the vector that is associated with this function thing. And then there's kind of this speciality that we have not seen working really so far. So there's this, well, it's maybe not the a good color to actually really perceive. So let's switch over to this one. So this box here carries a reference to the actual parameters that have already been bound to this functional object in earlier versions of applications where it was undersupplied with parameters. Long sentence, maybe you need time to parse that. But during the flow of such a program, you might find that such a functional value has already been tried to be applied at some point, but it is legal in a functional programming language to just give parts of the parameters to a function, and this binds the first few parameters of the function to the references that you have given to the function. This leaves still a few parameters unbound, at least potentially, so that if that happens, the function is not yet executed completely, but instead things are bound to the functional object, functional value object, and this now partially completed thing gives a new functional object that carries with itself a vector of parameters that have been bound so far. And later on, you can reuse this functional value object to complete the binding at some point, or to bind even more, but not complete it yet, depending on how the flow of your function is. But essentially, what can happen is that you carry with this functional object a few bindings for local variables, and an apply would have to make sure that, additionally to the functional object, to the parameters that came with the application in their kind of natural way on the stack itself, that you keep in mind that there have already been specified a few other parameters potentially a little bit earlier on. Those are the ones that are carried with the functional object over here. You need to make sure that they are merged together to be handled as the actual parameters of the function together. And this is what the apply is also doing. So the apply takes those and those and merges them together to this thing over here. We don't need to explicitly I didn't depict those parameters that are given to the whole, to the thing by its application expression in this graphics, but yeah.
If now two few arguments provided, and I call it, do I still call it apply then? Or, I mean, because they don't want to apply, but I mean,
you mean if the ones that I have circled in here don't suffice to fill every unbound? That will be handled with the TARC thing, but yeah, you couldn't successfully execute the function yet.
But then we would need to put something else than apply there.
Well,
assemble it at that point, but not execute it.
The TARC itself is, in that sense, a macro that when it is, when you look at how it is made up, it introduces another apply that, is it apply in that sense? In that respect? No, it just generates another functional object. So the apply, in case that there's under supplying of function, will in that sense also return, but it won't return with the value that is supposed to come out of the expression, but with a new functional object.
And how does apply now, the arguments are satisfied or not? Because it means like the number of arguments required.
Well, actually that is, again, in this TARCs thing, so it's a the functionality is distributed between the apply thing and the TARCs thing. At the point where you apply it to a functional object, you can't say because you don't really know how many parameters the function really expects. It can be a functional value that can have partially things already bound. You don't really know, but within the body of the function, you know, because there you are directly in the specification of the function, so there you know how many parameters you expect, and you can then evaluate. We'll see in this TARCs implementation how it does that. It's just a comparison of frame point and stack pointer, but yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, it's a little bit tricky. Well, anyway, this is how you just add more parameters to your to the ones that you have already bound. So the ones that you have already bound come on top of those that you have bound newly, and then control is given to the body of the function itself, where there's the TARC already waiting. So. But what is noteworthy maybe is that is the sequence or the order in which you have the arguments in the vector compared to the order that you have them on the stack. So they are supposed to be, if you run through the argument vector from left to right, you will run on the stack from bottom to top. So that way they correspond to each other. So the last element of the arguments vector will be found on top of the stack afterwards. So this is kind of the convention that we need to keep to. So this is what this it says. Okay, so now we're in this thing that we have already discussed a little bit. This is the matter of over and under supply of arguments. So far we have seen that there is this this argument vector that is carried with a functional object that carries with itself partially applied functions, the bindings that have been done already to this functional value. And in order to actually really do this in a meaningful way, we still need a few things to be done. Particularly, we need to somehow detect whether we are in situations of over or under supply. Also, we have to somehow react to that in a meaningful way so that we will generate the right notion of code. So, you've seen the apply prepare the stack as if, it doesn't really know a lot about what the callee really does. Particularly, it doesn't know how many parameters the Cauley actually really expects, because, well, depending on what flow the program had, it might have random number of arguments from the point of view of the caller. So what apply does is, we have seen the very last thing on the last slide was that it sets the continuation address to the body of the function, where we know that there is a TARG of k already waiting. This was the thing that we have generated in function definitions here as the introduction to the body, and then of course there's also a return k, but we will see later on what that is all about. So TRK will be the next instruction to be executed after the apply, usually. And this is now the place where this magic of over and under supply of arguments is really happening. Particularly, what you should keep in mind is that under supply, if you are in a situation of not being supplied with as many parameters as you would expect, so less than k, you would not want to really execute the function body, because you might run into variable names for which you don't have any bound have not bound any values or expressions or anything yet. So in these situations you would not want to execute, only in situations where you have at least as many parameters bound as you are expecting for your execution. So this TRK would be a nice place to actually check whether you would want to execute the function body or not. The criterion to use for whether you are in situations of undersupply or not would be, what could you use for that? Let's look back at our conceptual idea of the function frame. So, we would organize our stack this way. The frame pointer points to the organizational cells, and then we find that the arguments are directly above, while as there is space intended for local computations. But particularly at the start of a function, this is probably a thing that is not used at all yet, since there's no temporary computations, no let bindings or anything working right now. So all we will find on the stack so far is the arguments. So the stack pointer will point to this thing over here. So in order to really determine how many arguments we have, we would be interested in the actual size of the memory region between SP and FP, and this is quite easily done with just subtracting SP, FP from SP. And this gives us the actual number of arguments. So with that, we know in this TRK via this parameter K how many parameters we are expecting for a successful execution of the function. We know how many parameters we actually have gotten through SP minus FP. So we can now do case distinctions depending on what the comparison of those two things actually gives us. So that's what we're gonna do. The TRK then is working that way, where that we compare stack pointer to frame pointer for our number of actual parameters, compare it to k. In case that k is larger than our number of actual parameters, we have a situation of undersupply. Undersupply, we said, would be something that we would not want to want to execute the function body in that case. So instead, what else can we do? Well, the idea would be that although we can't really execute the body, what we still can do is we can add the newly provided parameters to our list of already partially bound parameters and pack them together with the functional or pack them to well yeah pack them together with the global vector and create a new functional value that we can return instead of an actual real value. And that is what we intend to do within the in this case. So there are several steps involved in that. First of all, we would like to create a new parameter vector with this make vector 0, which will pack the arguments that we have into a new vector to place it back into some f object that we will create within the wrap function. So the wrap thing creates a new f object with the data from the metadata from the last from last function, which is kind of the current function environment, together with the newly created argument vector, and in the end we will then pop the stack frame and just return this newly generated functional object. So this is what we are then supposed to do. There's this the first step, which is this make vec 0. So this make vec 0 was there to repack the arguments back into a vector. So that's what it's supposed to do. We have the arguments on top of the stack. We don't need to give this make vector a particular size as parameter, since we can determine how many parameters we have to pack into this thing by just looking at where the frame pointer points to. And everything between stack pointer and frame pointer is supposed to go into this new vector. So this is what's actually done. So this g goes into the size of the new vector, and all the parameters from here are going into this new vector like this. So they go there and are replaced with a reference to this newly generated vector. And again, we have to make sure that the access pattern is used with the same conventions as we had when we unpacked such a parameter vector. So the topmost cell needs to go to the last cell in the vector, and we can ensure to do that by iterating from the right direction through these things. And this is the responsibility of the runtime system that interprets this make vector to really get the indices right and iterate with the right pattern over the stack. So this repacks the parameters back into a vector and leaves the reference to this vector on the top of the stack. So now what we need to do is to recreate a functional object, a functional value object, out of our current execution situation, because we unpacked the function object in the process of applying. So now we have to revert that and regenerate a functional object in the TARG thing, and that's what is performed through the wrap thing. So the wrap emanates from the that's happening quite often today. So this emanates from the reference to the bound parameters on top of the stack, and the global pointer pointing to what is supposed to be the global environment for this functional object f, and the continuation address of this thing. And what it will do is it will the wrap will now recreate a new functional object. The functional object, you can see being created over here. It has several components. It first of all needs, of course, an entry to a function. How the heck can we obtain the new entry to the function? Well, right now we are in the execution of the function body itself already. What we need is to restore a pointer to the beginning of this code block. What we know is that in principle, well, we are within the execution of this targ thing, which was the kind of first instruction of the function body. So instead of continuing with whatever comes in the program counter now, when we turn back our instruction sequence a little bit to one address before, we are finding ourselves right at the start of this targ thing, which would be the entry point of the function. So that is what we will actually fill in here in this functional object. This is just the PC minus one. We won't modify the PC because we still need to continue with whatever follows here, but still this 41 is a meaningful entry point for the function, can be used for this newly created function object. The GP part of the thing will be filled with the GP part from down here. So far, nothing new. And the AP part is just the reference that we have created newly here. This is the partially bound parameters. So they go, they stay in memory like this and just are referred to from here on in the functional object. And yeah, the reference to this functional object goes here. This make vector zero?
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is
This is
the vector of partially provided things now merged with whatever has been provided earlier on in the functional object together with the actual parameters of the renew apply application. So this is the situation after the wrap. So now what remains to do is to somehow we can't do anything more in this particular execution of the thing, so we have to pop the current stack frame and return to the application point. So this is what the popenv does. This will now restore the previous frame pointer, will restore the program counter and the GP from before. This is everything that it finds to be pointed to by the FP. It has to remove the parameters given here on the stack and just conserve the top of the stack as the return value, which contains now a functional value object with a partial application of parameters involved. So that's what popenv then does. The reference to the functional object goes to the new top of the stack. Those cells here go, 42 goes into the program counter. This is another 42 as this one. It might not be chosen too cleverly, so this is actually something different than before. So don't think that these values are the same just because they come from one page to the other. It's just, my boss's understanding of having funny numbers in there. So, 42 goes just there. The whatever the global pointer has been pointing to before goes now back into the global pointer register, and the frame pointer is restored to whatever has been pointed to by this part, which is that cell, so the FP goes there. So this is the restoration of the earlier state with now a new functional object on top of the stack as being the return value of an application that didn't suffice to provide as many parameters as would have been expected. So we get a new partially applied function back. Okay, so putting that all together in one sequence of diagrams. So this is the situation back at the start of a function. but in case of undersupply. So the case that we have talked about. Just to illustrate you now with kind of the complete information and the sequence of instructions that we have seen, what happens here. So the situation is like the one that you see here. We have we are ready to roll our function. So targ is executed. We detect that there's undersupply happening. So what first is done is make vector 0 is called to pack the parameter part like this. So we have a new vector with the partially provided parameters. Then with wrap, we put that in a new function object like this and pop the parameters from the stack. Now popenv will take this new function object to be the return value of the function itself, leading to that situation. So this is what happens in case of undersupply. In case of not undersupply, we've seen that this is just falling through to whatever comes behind. So the actual code of the function is executed. It should work as intended, as there's at least as many parameters given as need to be bound. So there is no problem in doing the actual execution. The only thing is that, well, it's not the only abnormality in that sense, that there is the under supply of parameters. You can, of course, apply exactly as many parameters as are needed, but there's also the situation of over apply, where you have or you find more parameters in this expression as actually really expected for this particular function value object. So before you start executing the actual body of the function, you don't care. But as soon as you reach the end of the function, at some point you have to deal with these parameters that are provided that are in over or contributing to the oversupply of arguments. And what the semantics of this language says is that in that case, you would expect the function to have generated a return value which is expected to be a functional object once again. And the semantics of this oversupply would say that the parameters that have been given to, have been applied originally to your function are now meant to be applied to whatever you have produced as a result value. So you need to reapply sort of with your oversupply of arguments, and that is what this return k is all about. So this now continues the case tests in this part over here, which now tests whether the number of arguments together with the newly created return value, which resides on top of the stack, is in situation of oversupply or exact supply. This k plus 1 is the exact supply case, where you have k many parameters plus your return value. In that situation, you can just destroy your stack frame and slide the result down to whatever to the new top of the stack. So remove all the parameters. However, if we don't have this exact supply, we will need to reapply the resulting function value to the remaining parameters. And this can be achieved by sliding down the functional value by the amount of parameters that we have bound in this last application and reapply. With that, we bind the remaining parameters to the functional value that we have created as, in our current function as return value, and bind them together and reapply. Thus, kind of you're reusing this stack frame in that sense. So the return has two cases. In case that we have decided that the parameters have exactly met our expectations, so we have had k parameters. This is the situation that you find. So here we find that there have been k fields plus one for our return value found on top of the stack at the end of executing my function body. So fp, the difference between sp and fp is exactly k plus one. In that case, we can just run into a popenv, which will usually just remove the content of the stack and rewind the stack frame to, well, what we find here. So this the result value from here goes down there, and the management cells from or organizational cells from here go into the right places where they needed to go. This goes there. So that is what happens in the case of exact supply. In case of oversupply, we had more parameters on the stack than necessary for the application with our function. So the situation is like here. The k is so many stacks like this. There's the plus one for the return value, and there's still more than k plus one things between SP and FP. And this is a situation where we have not used up all the parameters in our current application. So what we can expect is that the topmost cell necessarily needs to be a functional value object. So this is a F thing. And what we then want to do is we want to remove these K things because we have consumed or bound them already to our current function application. So we remove them with a slide and then continue on with applying this functional object to the parameter that is left on top of the stack with an apply, thus kind of reusing the frame that we have generated for the application of the earlier function. And that's totally plausible to do. So with that, we have handled the oversupply of parameters and are in that sense done with the actual execution of the thing. So any question on the function definition, execution, application, oversupply, undersupply? Maybe not yet, but maybe later on. Yeah?
Because we have all this, I mean, it's a little general, but we always have this function building up the stack, building down the stack, right? And then this is all fine. I mean, in my imagination, for CPD, in a CPD case, because you just have the immediate value. But when you have an expression which is later, so a CPDN situation, so you have variables, a CPN targets, a CPN. It needs to be evaluated at a later point, right?
Yeah.
Eventually. So, where is that code for that evaluation? Is it, I mean, it's still somewhere in the stack. I didn't quite get that.
So, the thing is that I haven't shown you the code generation for code C yet. So, that is the point where there's.
Okay.
Yeah. The trick is just that we, so far we have implemented this CBN by saying that at clever positions, we didn't use code V, but code C, but didn't say what code C is.
Okay, so agile.
And essentially, this will just create closures, which are then caught by the eval that you find within the expression evaluation later on. And this
just wondered where this closure would lie on.
It's just strategic placement of code C and the corresponding eval. The eval will just be found usually within the use of these variables. Well, for once, it's I think the global bindings have an eval. They should have an eval somewhere, and then there's the actual evaluation of the expressions that can come within the expressions that belong to the functions. So these are the two places where the eval is triggered, and then it's just a matter of switching from code V to code C. In that sense, it's quite, you can kind of parameterize your compiler of functional language to either go the CBV or the CBN direction, just put the flag in there and switch from one code generation scheme to the other depending on which context you are in. Yeah, the closures come, I think, after the let rec things, but this will be a matter of Monday, I guess. Okay. Yeah. So the let rec expressions. These are the ones that you that we have so far spared ourselves to look at. So this is a let expression with a modifier in there, this rec thingy. And this means that you now, instead of the situation before where you could only use the variable yi in the expression ey plus 1, you can now instead refer to this variable yi within the expression ey also. So this makes it possible to introduce recursive declarations of functions and variables, for example. Variables, I don't know whether this really makes sense, but the functions are quite common in that sense. So in order to be able to do so, we somehow need to refer to names before we have really defined them. So what the idea is here is to beforehand already allocate variables on in the memory somewhere so that we can really refer to them in terms of indices and initialize them with some kind of dummy value in that sense, and then later on fill them depending on whatever you have defined for them. So, again, there's this CBV and CBN distinction here. Depending on how they are, how your semantics is, you either evaluate the expressions directly and bind them to the values, or construct closures. And there goes your deferred execution of things. You just trigger the closure generation instead of the value object generation, and then evaluate the expression E0 as its value is the return value of this expression. So, as I've said, in the let rec, we need to refer to variables that within their actual definition. So at the point of time where we allocate space for them, we don't have concrete values for them. Instead, we use dummy values until we really know what we need to store in there. So, how does that really look like in terms of code generation schemes? So, the expression looks like this with a let rec from y1 to yn, and in the course of translating that, we will need access to n many variables. So what we first of all do is allocate n many cells on the stack, and then perform closure code generation for E1 to EN. So there's the code generations for E1 to EN. Of course, with a stack distance, which is now larger by N because we have allocated N many cells before. And what essentially has to be done now is that after the code generation has happened for these things, these closures that have been created during this code C thing now reside as references on top of a stack, and we still need to connect them to their handles to which they have been bound. So whatever this E1 has evaluated to as a closure has to be bound to the correct name. And this name is usually referred to via an index on the stack, and the reference can be obtained from there. So what we need to do is we have to fill whatever we have computed as closure into its according cell with a rewrite instruction, which will manipulate the original value that has been generated for this thing on the stack with the contents from whatever it finds on top of the stack. And this goes for all the bindings that we have introduced. They all rewrite their original initialization so that in the end we can then call these codes, can generate the value object code for E0 and make use of these things in their bound form. Yeah, in terms of address environment, the address environment for each of these bindings will look like the general environment with just the newly introduced binding variables yi bound to local variables on stack distance plus I, because that's the way that we generate the code for them. So the this E1 goes to N, EN goes to 1, so that's how we bind them to the local things. So in case of call by value, we will usually then use just value code generation for the expressions. Okay. Yeah, recursive definitions of basic values don't make sense in CBV. In CBN, of course, yeah, I can imagine that this actually really makes sense. So, what would that look like in an example? So, this is the example, I think, from the very start of our MAMA part of the lecture. This is the... is that the faculty function? Oh, no, it's not... yeah, I think so. So, let's have a look at how this translates. So there's the recursive definition of the f function in the expression f1. First of all, we need to allocate 1 for the f thing. By the way, have you seen what the alloc really does? Oh, it comes behind. Okay, sorry. So the alloc 1 will reserve space on the stack for the f, and f will then be a valid mapping in the address environment used for the expression over here for this functional declaration. And this then, let's check whether there is any free variables. No, both of them are bound in the thing, so there is no well, yeah, there is. There is this f thing. This this is a free variable for this definition. So f is actually a global value, a global variable for that sense. So what we need to do is we need to push the local, because this is a lead binding, so this would be considered to be a local variable. So to push local of the first thing for stack distance of 1, it will be a push log of 0, and this will serve as a global value to be used in the definition of this function. So we create a global vector out of that and create a functional value with that and jump over the whole thing, which will then end in whatever we see here. Then the function itself will be treated here in this in the part of the expression which just contributes the declaration of the function. This is this outer box that I draw here. Let's move this thing. So it's just this thing. This is locally treated as an expression that is found there and is checked for free variables. And if we just look at that part and ignore the part before, this f is considered to be global in the scope of just this function. But since it is occurring in the context of a lead binding, the lead binding surrounding that introduced for this name the locally interpreted thing, name f. So for the global pointer, you have to access the local variable f. It's a matter of scoping. Depending on how far you are within the expression, the notion changes. If you look at the larger expression, it's again a local variable and isn't considered to be free anymore, since it's bound in the let expression. Yeah, it just depends on how large your scope is at a particular point. So it's not a thing that you can talk about without any making precise where you're referring to. Anyway, for our purposes here, we expect two parameters. So there's this tr2 and a return of 2. And this is how the whole thing is specified. How it is translated is left open here. It's not so interesting for our purposes here. So apart from that, after this declaration is finally translated, we have to enter that into its according heap object. So that's why there is this rewrite of the first binding, and after that we continue with the expression that is after the in, and this is then this call of a function with parameter 1. So this there's a mark here. Entering C as the continuation address into the function frame, together with the other management cells, then you create the parameter thing as a reference to the basic value 1. Pack that into memory, and then you. You load that as the push the load the name of the f with this push local binding 1 was introduced with this let binding, so this is a push local 4 because of stack distance minus 1. So with that, you generate the function object for f, do the apply, and then in the end, slide over your first parameter and return whatever the f returns. So this all needs the instruction alloc that does the allocation of arbitrarily many dummy objects, which is this alloc n, which just creates a few references to new heap cells C for now, and then in the end you need to fill in whatever you have come up with real values for those things into the newly generated cells, and this is what the rewrite does. Please note that this is not like this. You don't change the actual pointer there. No. This is not what you do. You really change the content of what is found in this heap cell to be whatever has been found in this heap element. So this is what the rewrite is supposed to do. So this is necessary because the actual address where this points to, or the reference that is used there, is actually incorporated into the code generation schemes for the respective binding of the recursive variable. And you need to this needs, of course, that this reference remains constant. Okay, so with that we would reach closures and the evaluation, but we are already out of time, and thus closures will be a topic for next time. So thank you for your attention and have fun in the tutorial.